If you're ready to learn how technology is driving business innovation in Cincinnati and beyond, you're tuned in to the right podcast. Join us for interviews and discussions with business leaders, innovators, and visionaries. With our host, Sam Schulte, CEO of Unstoppable Software, this is Unstoppable Talk.
All right, so we are here today with John Reichel from Color 9. John is the managing partner and founder of Color 9, based here in Cincinnati, Ohio, also with offices in Charlotte, North Carolina. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Sam.
So today, some of the topics we were going to talk about is around the impact of technology on marketing and PR, which is what your company works with, sort of the marketing landscape of what clients are doing with the latest technologies, what's new and innovative, and some of the biggest upcoming innovations that you see are sort of bleeding edge and so on and so forth. So maybe a place to start is talk to me a little bit about or tell us a little bit about how you started the company and how you kind of got into this.
Sure. So I worked at a number of ad agencies, PR agencies in Detroit, where I'm from, and then here in Cincinnati. I've been in Cincinnati now for about 22 years now, and worked at a lot of the larger agencies, usually in a public relations role, but always in an integrated marketing setting. So the places I worked always worked on creative and digital solutions and websites and media buying. So it was always the full package. So that was the experience I kind of grew up in my career. So when I started my own company in 2009, that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to focus on just one thing. If you're a website company, your solution for your client is always to build a new website. If you're a PR company, it's always to do a new PR campaign. So we wanted to be an integrated problem-solving shop to come in and really try to understand at a strategic level what clients were experiencing, what obstacles were they coming up against, what problems were they finding with their marketing, and then how could we help them solve those problems in a creative and strategic way.
Cool. So when you started the company, what was sort of your first big break then where you got to utilize and do things sort of in the way you wanted to do them? What were some of the big opportunities you first got to get started?
Yeah, when we first started Color 9, I'd come from a different agency, so I had to start from scratch. I wasn't able to bring any clients with me or anything like that, so I actually used technology. I used LinkedIn and Facebook and some of those tools to, which were newer back in 2009,
yeah,
to just try to get the word out of what I was doing next. And I got a call from the Cincinnati USA Convention and Visitors Bureau, and they were interested in my background, having worked on similar work in my career, and got a meeting with them, and they gave me a test project, really small and really focused on PR. And within a year of that, we were doing their annual meeting. We were doing a lot of writing. We were designing their annual report, doing some digital projects, really the whole gamut. And 10 years later, they're still a client of ours. So that was the first big break, and it was technology related in terms of how we kind of connected with them. And it's been a great relationship ever since.
And that's really I think that sort of continues to be a lot of your specialty, your focus is sort of marketing and media and PR for not exactly government agencies or anything like that, but more sort of local, chambers of commerce and visitors bureaus and things like that. It seems like you work with a lot of, I don't know what you would call those exactly, but
Those kind of civic organizations. It's been a good niche for us. We didn't go into it thinking that we would focus on certain niches. We probably should have, but that definitely ended up being one of them. And healthcare is another one that's emerged over the last few years for us. And it's good because now we've got all this experience in both of those realms that we can bring to the table for other clients and show them how we solve problems within that space.
Yeah, because definitely, clients like to see sort of that recurring past experience they can base, their decisions on, what worked for so-and-so and so forth.
They do. Right? It's a big thing in the marketing world, right? If you have this client list and the logos of clients that you've done good work for and solved problems for and have sustained a relationship with over a period of time, then that makes a big difference in terms of what other companies are looking for.
Sure. So, and what do you think for those clients and just the work you're doing recently, What are some of the biggest ways that technology, in your opinion, has impacted the marketing industry? If we just look at like the last 2 years, what's sort of been real hot recently?
So I graduated from college in 1991. And so I look back sometimes on the difference in technology then, when really there wasn't any to speak of. Email was just kind of getting off the ground in terms of its wide application. And then look at Color 9 when we started in 2009 and the technology there. And it's completely different. The way our clients are marketing themselves and the ways that we're helping them is completely different now than it was 10 years ago. And it's really markedly different than it was even 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
In terms of the emergence of social media, you know, the way artificial intelligence and apps are involved in so many aspects of what clients are doing, the impact, the growth of Google. And the use of Google AdWords and search and SEO and SEM and the much larger proportion of budget that clients are pushing toward that. I would say that it's gone from maybe 15% of a company's marketing spend is on digital, now up to 85 or 90%.
Oh, wow. It's a real reversal.
Completely, yeah.
How's that affected sort of all the more traditional print and, you know, I mean, you still see people doing billboards and you know, you do certainly get mailers in the mail. I mean, you know, look at coming into like campaign season and stuff here, you're going to get plenty of stuff in the mail still. So they're still doing that. You know, is that something that, I mean, they're doing it, but they're spending less on it. So it seems like you sort of have to be good at like a lot more things, right?
Yeah, and even in those realms, when you look at billboards, so many of them now are digital boards, so that you can actually do a billboard buy but have different creative go up every day. You know, the Reds are doing that downtown with kind of showcasing the game of the day that's happening there. So and with direct mail, you know, very old school kind of thing, and it's definitely dying, but it's interesting how that's kind of evolved with technology too, where you can personalize your direct mail.
Yeah.
People are doing more dimensional mailers than they are just the flat postcard that usually gets thrown right in the trash. So how can you do a dimensional personalized piece on a very maybe small run to a very targeted audience that you're trying to reach? That's where people are taking, again, some of these more old school kind of projects and turning them around and trying to be more focused with them.
Yeah. Exactly. No, it's interesting, the digital, because, you know, in digital signage in general, I mean, you see that in restaurants now. And so folks I know that print menus and or, you know, the big hang on the wall type menus or whatever.
Yeah.
Of course, that landscape is changing. I don't know if we'll see, you know, direct mail that's somehow digital, like little mailing people tablets that change or whatever. But certainly they're going to find some way to put ads in front of you, right?
Yeah, and a lot of those menus, even in the restaurant realm, which we don't do a lot of work in, but those are going right to mobile, where you can actually go to Yelp or go to that and have a – they either allow you to upload that right on your phone or they'll hand you a tablet when you walk in. So your menu experience and your ordering experience is all digital within the restaurant. Yeah. So, yeah, it's changing every single industry. In really dramatic ways.
Well, it seems like when you look at, because one of the interesting things about digital marketing is that you can actually successfully, if you spend the time and do it right, connect it all together and tie it together so you know, okay, this person watched this video, this person read this email. And of course, if you spend the time and build the systems up, you can see that whole path of what they did. You know, they visited your website, downloaded your PDF, you know, interacted with something, right? And of course, then becomes a little bit of a challenge when you want to know, well, did they receive that postcard I sent them? And you got to do QR codes, your custom web links or URLs right. and stuff, you know. But it is kind of interesting that I imagine when you started, there was really no way to have any kind of traceability, right?
No, you were just trying to do big broad-based numbers like impressions and, you know, the size of your mailing list and those kinds of things. And it's so different. And that's really why the dollars, I think, are going there. In such a speedy way, because everything's measurable now.
Yeah, exactly.
And like you said, you can know who's, you know, if you use something like Constant Contact or MailChimp, just a simple piece of technology like that, that's been around for a while, you can know who opened your email, who clicked on what link. And it really is a great tool, a very fundamental, but solid tool that still a lot of companies aren't using.
Yeah.
To know which prospects opened your email and clicked on a link. Cause it really, can accelerate the sales process if you can call and say, hey, and know that they read a certain story on your e-newsletter or that they opened it but then closed it quickly.
Didn't watch it all the way through.
Right. It gives you a lot of information. On Facebook, you can post videos there. So video is just a huge piece of technology that we're working a lot more on with clients. Videos being incorporated into every single aspect of all of their marketing. But you can post video ads on there, and you can know how many and who has clicked on that to watch the whole video, how many have only watched 3 seconds of that video and then gotten out of it. So again, the information and the data that comes through on all these things is amazing. But then there's a lot of skill involved in interpreting it, right? So what does all that mean? What does that mean for how you should be spending your money going forward? What does it mean for analyzing what's working and what's not? And I think it's cut down on patience in our industry too. So our clients don't feel as inclined to have to let some creative projects breathe and have the patience with them because it didn't produce the immediate numbers that they had expected they would. So then they get out of it really quick on a project and they move on to the next thing. So there's some danger in the technology too, right? That you don't fully comprehend all the data, that you are spreading your resources too thin across all of these different digital channels that are at your disposal. And so there's a lot of waste that can happen too, even though you have all the measurables in front of you.
Yeah. Well, and it's true. I mean, I think, just in some of the efforts I've worked alongside with clients, and maybe not directly working for them on it, but, around digital marketing they've been doing, it's quite possible that they might have a gold mine they're not aware of because, maybe they spend $300 on Google ads and they get two or three leads and they think, oh, I only got two or three leads. It's like, yeah, that's an incredible return rate.
Right.
But they just don't connect with that because they think, well, for $300 though, I could blah, 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 or something, and it's not connecting. And
well, we have a client that we did a Facebook lead ad for, and they put a very modest amount, $50, on it. Now, one new client for this customer of ours means about $1,800 in revenue over the course of a year. So they did the lead ad, and it produced 5 leads. Now, their first blush reaction to that was, like you said, 5 leads.
Yeah.
Well, if one of them turns into a client, which their close rate on once they get people in the door to sell them is about 75%. So if they can get 3 of them in the door and sell 2 of them, I mean, they've made, 100 times the spend on it. So the small numbers shouldn't scare you away. It isn't all just about numbers. Too often we get kind of focused on quantity instead of quality with the technology, the tools that we have, and you got to keep that radar up to know exactly what you're looking for.
Yeah, and it is interesting too. Just the sheer number of companies that aren't effectively really active in the space, marketing their firms effectively in this way. I run into companies all the time, and I speak to them that don't have a website. And it's kind of remarkable, like what? And that's probably the minority of companies. I mean, a very small number of them, but even those that have websites, if you look at like law firms and stuff, for instance, they're not really doing a whole lot. There's probably only a handful of law firms, for instance, in Cincinnati that are really leveraging, all these sort of channels of digital marketing effectively, and they're just not out there. I mean, there's so many little segments like that. That I think that there's tremendous opportunity that if you're in a niche segment, and there's some, because the thing is the people that pull it off and invest in it and do it well, we know who they are. Like, who's,
right.
I think I've mentioned on this show before, like if you say, hey, who's somebody out there marketing really heavily for like HVAC work? Well, you can name 2 or 3 companies, that you see their billboards, their videos, their Facebook ads, their LinkedIn posts, they're just everywhere. And then there's the other 400 companies that are doing nothing,
Right.
And I don't think it's any accident that the companies really out there, Apollo and these guys that have really strong brands, are growing tremendously faster than any of those and any of the rest of those to a large degree, I think.
Right. And it's the chicken and the egg thing too, where they think, if I can get bigger, then I would have some money and then I can do some of that stuff.
Yeah.
but you're not going to get bigger unless you actually spend and invest in your marketing. So yeah, it's really interesting. You know, back in the 90s, you know, you would look at companies and they were just starting to build websites, and you would ask a client, well, why do you want to talk to us about building a website? And it's like, well, that's what everybody's doing. It's kind of the cool thing. So there was no business rationale a lot of the time behind it, right? Yeah. They just wanted it because it was the cool new thing. And so we see a lot of that too. Like, why do you want to do this? Or why do you want to, you know, pursue that opportunity with Snapchat? Or, yeah, well, that it seems cool.
Yeah.
And so that's really bad business rationale, and you're risking wasting a lot of money on something that you're just doing because it's neat.
Yeah.
And so that's where again, we now more than ever, I think clients really value that we come in and try to solve a problem. Because, you know, 20 years ago, when you looked at it, there were probably 8 ways to solve that particular problem. Now there's 800 ways to solve that problem. Yeah. Because you can use a variety of apps and technology and you know, all kinds of digital marketing tools and traditional tools and ads and events and whatever else it might be. And it can be overwhelming. And so in that same way, 20 years ago, the director of marketing had to manage kind of, you know, a handful of disciplines. He kind of had to know print, and he had to know some PR, and he had to know a little bit about the web space, and he had to know direct mail, and he had to know kind of events and trade shows and things like that if it's a B2B environment. Now that same person has to really try to understand, you know, 100 different categories, mm-hmm. and 100 different channels that he could pursue. And so the best ones are the ones that don't think they know all that, yeah. right? And they try to pull in resources and build a team internally and externally that can help them just figure out what the best options are. And not throw money at things that are short term or that are just pretty looking,
yeah.
But things that really align with what your strategy is, no matter what that strategy is.
Well, and it is I think you're right. It is a challenge that's sort of presented by this omni-channel marketing type of idea, right? Which is just, you know, which is what we try to be at Unstoppable Software. We try to be omni-channel just because we see that, you know, if we look at all of our leads that come in, we get maybe a handful of leads or in whatever time period from every channel, you know. And if someone comes into us from Facebook, they may not have come into us from LinkedIn. So clearly, you know, you want to expose yourself to all that. The downside is that all of those channels require expertise to understand them. You know, even like a direct mail channel, there's a way to do it right. Right. Yeah. And if you just say, well, I'm just going to type something up in a, you know, in Microsoft Word and print it and mail it out to 5,000 people or something, it's not going to work. It's a waste of time.
And it's amazing, like you kind of hinted at before, that happens a lot still.
Yeah.
Which is amazing to me.
Yeah.
Well, because you even have tools now like VistaPrint and yeah. everything else that can at least give you some kind of appearance of some kind of professionalism yeah. in it. But still, a lot of them don't. And it's either the, I don't have money to do that, which just really isn't a good excuse anymore, or I don't have time,
yeah.
which is an even worse excuse because, again, you can get resources that can do this stuff if you do your homework on it.
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, I think the skills required to do a good direct mail campaign are very different than the skills required to do an email nurturing campaign or drip campaign. Yeah. I mean, look at everything that's required, all the tools and techniques, understanding. So I think it puts a lot of pressure on, you know, agencies such as you guys to know how to do all those things and to have the right people and staff and talents, as well as, like you said, the marketing managers to figure out, you know, how to select and find the right vendors. And because, I mean, I think that, I mean, granted, you don't want to just be scattershot and say, well, we're just going to be on, you know, all platforms maybe, because there's probably ones that are not effective for you, right? I mean,
right.
You know, Twitch, for instance, which is really popular for like live streaming video games and such, you know, is that the best place to do infomercial type stuff for, say, an HVAC company?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? You know?
Well, and again, it's a lot of it's just about being a good listener too and trying yeah. to, again, hear what that problem is. So we just did a complete website overhaul for a national healthcare organization.
Mm-hmm.
And we got it built, and it was, they kind of built it, you know, the way we built it, the way they asked us to. And we had a lot of strategic insight that kind of went into how we kind of set up the navigation and the content flow and all of that stuff. And so the client came back and then said, well, how do we know that what this, that the strategy that we implemented to build this thing is actually happening in real life? So then we were able to come back and we implemented another simple tool, inexpensive tool called Mouseflow, which allows you to go in and actually see person by person where the mouse goes when they visit your website, right? Yeah. So how long did they linger on a page? Then what did they click? And then how long did they linger on that page and where did their mouse go? Then where did their mouse go next? And you get to see every single visitor, that little snapshot of the user experience and how they traveled through your site.
Yeah.
And so it was really illuminating for them, and it solved this mystery that they had in their head of how our customers experiencing our site. And it was $29.
Yeah.
You know? And so again, it was to be able to build the technology to go suggest that solution 5 years ago would have been thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And for them it was $29 and it answered a question that they had in a cool way.
Well, and the proliferation of cheap SaaS-based marketing tools like that give you just so much power. You know, I mean, there's lifetime deals on all these tools sometimes that it's $50 forever, you know?
Right.
And like you said, if you had wanted to do that, you could have done that 10 years ago, but you would have been building it custom. You would have been hiring us to build it, and it would have cost you, you know, six figures probably to build that or something. But you're right, though, that watching that real customer interaction, because I've done that before with our site, and it's like, wow, you know, I noticed you don't have to watch everyone do it, because of course, you know, you can make a heat map or, you know, where you average them all together, for instance, and see, but even just watching a couple of users interact with it live, which is really interesting to do, because you realize that it seems like they're having trouble figuring out how to fill out this form, or gee, I watched three people and I just saw that they got to the part where it asked for their phone number and they just left.
Right.
Or something, right?
Yeah, or we thought that the navigation setup was going to push people here and it really didn't. And so we need to tweak and improve as we go. And so it gives you the opportunity to do that.
Yeah. So what do you think, I guess we talked about ROI a little bit and such. I guess I'm curious, you know, if you were a small company out there that say had like a $5,000 budget for marketing, say I want to get my brand out there, where would you spend $5,000? On what channels, what areas, what would you spend it on?
Yeah. And we get that question a lot. Mm-hmm. And then we come back and we say, well, what issue are you trying to solve? What's your strategic plan? What's your strategic objective for the next quarter? Mm-hmm. Do you have 5,000 a month? Do you have 5,000 for the year? Do you have 5,000 for the next 3 months? If it's for the next 3 months, what's your issue? So we just actually just started engaging with a new client, and they're in a space where they have built a database over a number of years. So they've got all these clients that have signed up for a free demo, right, that was offered. And most do it after the demo, and then some don't. And so a guy that we have been connected with bought the company. And so he's had it for about a year now, and he's looking at just what he bought, right?
Yeah.
And he's trying to figure out the best strategic way to get the most out of it. So for him, it was a process of trying to map a process for handling your sales leads in the most effective way. And one of the big things was, let's go to this database that nobody's touched in years, right? But that is current and has hundreds of names on it of people who took a major step to purchase, but then for whatever reason didn't. And you never found out why they didn't. And maybe it was just a timing thing and you just need to kind of touch base with them again. So for them, it would be $5,000 spent on a very targeted campaign to build a channel marketing strategy so that you have touch points across all of those. And it may be phone calls, emails, letters, whatever that might be. And then a strategy for hitting this one segment of your audience that you haven't hit before and really trying to understand where they fell off in that process and why.
Well, that's a good point, you know, because the question is, it's a little bit too generic to say, what would you spend $5,000 on, right? Because it's not in a vacuum, you know, if somebody asks you that.
I think that's the danger of stuff like that, is just to say, and you have clients that do that too, well, if I don't spend this $5,000, I lose it. So I just need to spend it.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's okay, because we don't want to lose it for next year. And so we can do something quickly and knock it out. But other times, you know, we want to make sure that we've got a really good strategic rationale for why we're suggesting something and why it makes sense given all of the other things, because all these factors matter. Like, who is your target audience? What are you trying to get them to do? Who are your kind of secondary and tertiary audiences, and what are you trying to get them to do? What does your existing client base look like? What are your new product offerings look like? How is your web presence? Where are most of your leads coming from? When you receive objections, what do they look like and sound like, and why are you getting them? So once we have some answers to all of those things, it actually becomes pretty easy for us to look at this massive tool belt of all the things you can do and say, yeah, I would go do this.
Yeah.
So that could mean $5,000 on a couple of new landing pages and a targeted marketing campaign. It could mean, attacking your social media channels with some branded content and boosted posts and lead ads across Facebook and Instagram because of the audience you're trying to reach. It could mean going doing a digital outdoor board for a quarter and trying to do that. So again, I think that's where we're good. Being able to look at that puzzle of what's your strategy, what budget do you have, what are you trying to accomplish here, and in what time frame, and let us help you kind of manage that enormous tool belt that is so much bigger than it was 10 years ago, and help you make the right decisions.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's take a quick break. We've talked a lot on this podcast about marketing technologies, or MarTech, but what does it all mean? Welcome to the Geek Out. MarTech is a name for analysis platforms that manage paid promotions, influencers, and social media, and there's thousands of tools and platforms out there. In fact, there's thousands of software applications listed in the MarTech 5000 in areas as diverse as advertising and promotion, content and experience, social and relationships, commerce and sales. And in 2018, Gartner reported that MarTech was the single most important area of investment for marketing resources by CMOs. Almost 30% of companies' marketing budgets were allocated to software platforms. This is much different than in the past, perhaps a decade ago, when the largest portions of a company's marketing budget were allocated usually to TV or radio paid spots. And nowadays, $1 out of every $6 spent by CMOs are invested in innovation and cutting-edge approaches that might be unproven in the marketplace. There's a lot of new efforts out there, some of which are still getting new terms and names, such as extended reality or XR, which is one of the newest terms. That's a wrap-up term that includes virtual reality, where customers interact in virtual worlds, augmented reality, which adds layers of virtual objects over the top of images of the real world, and mixed reality, which is a term Microsoft defines as augmented reality objects that interact with the real world as if it were a virtual one. With all these new options out there for marketing, it's important to look at a few trends that are really pushing us in this direction. According to HubSpot, using videos on landing pages will increase conversions by up to 86%, so it's a very popular method of advertising and reaching your customers. At the same time, up to 65% of 25 to 49-year-olds speak to their voice-enabled devices at least once a day, so there's a lot of different ways to engage with customers. For content marketing, 81% of companies use their blog as a central marketing strategy, and 17% of marketers plan to launch a podcast in the next 12 months. So there's a lot of different content angles out there. Some other interesting statistics are around the continued growth of social media. There are around 2.1 billion Facebook accounts currently, but as many as 270 million of them are fake. Nevertheless, 43% of adults get most of their news from Facebook. LinkedIn, which we use heavily, has around 500 million total users, but more than a third of those are paid accounts, paid professional accounts, and almost half of all LinkedIn users visit the site every day, making it one of the most effective platforms for engaging business customers. Overall, it's clear that marketing technology platforms and the tools that manage them are only going to grow in their importance to businesses and the impact they have on the day-to-day lives of consumers. The trick is using the right tools and the right strategy and working with a team that knows how to put it all together for you. podcast is brought to you by Unstoppable Software. At Unstoppable, we bolt onto your company's team to accelerate their ability to deliver customized web, mobile, and desktop software applications. With our deep experience in manufacturing, engineering, healthcare, and other industries, we know the way your business operates and can help you come up with ideas for new software-based processes that are proven to save you money. To learn more about how we make our clients unstoppable, visit us at unstoppablesoftware.com or call us at 513-382-8499. And now, back to Unstoppable Talk.
And what do you think about, you know, something I've read recently that some of the big names in the industry of digital marketing are talking about, you know, the Gary Vaynerchuks and these other guys that you follow out there that you see a lot. You know, they're talking a lot about brand and how the only thing that matters is brand and the channels and all that and what you say and, you know, all the real details don't matter. It's just brand, brand, brand. And that's going to be more and more and more the case. I think they're saying that because there's so much noise and so much information that nobody has time to watch a 5-minute explainer video talking about, well, here's how we do what we do. I don't have time for that, right? All I have time is I'm just going to see your logo in passing, more or less. And that's not just a logo, of course, but like I'm going to see your logo and I'm going to get a feeling and I'm going to have some sort of a core root connection of, and I think that's why they're saying that is because there's so much noise and competition in the market.
Right.
So they're almost, and I'm not saying I agree with them, but I think some of them are sort of saying like story doesn't matter almost, right? Or at least the story that matters is just how it relates and ties into your brand. So how do you think that sort of importance of brand for all companies, let's say, is changing in the market?
Yeah, and I think they're less saying that story doesn't matter, and they're more saying that you need a touch point strategy to build toward when the story does matter. So in the B2B world, which is where a lot of my past experience was, you know, back in the 90s, the number we were always told was you need a certain number of touch points in the B2B world of your brand before you'll get a decision from somebody. And that was 7. So you need 7 touch points, right? And so now the latest I've read is that you need 21 touch points.
Yeah.
So 3 times as many. So if you need 21 touch points, you don't get a chance to tell your story 21 times in there.
Yeah.
Like you said, it may be a logo in passing. It may be a Facebook post that I didn't really read, but maybe I saw the brand represented in some way. Maybe I saw it on a billboard. I saw it on a TV spot. I saw it on a Pandora ad and so on and so forth. And then when I'm ready to so now I've kind of laid some groundwork there, right? And I've hit 15 touch points, but I haven't really kind of hit home with it yet, then maybe I'm ready for the story and I see something delivered, again, probably digitally, mm-hmm. and maybe it's a longer form story or it's something on Vimeo or YouTube or whatever it might be, and I'm gonna invest the 3 minutes to kind of hear the longer story. Mm-hmm. And now the sale happened. So I think it's both. You need that touch point strategy and you need kind of that onslaught to be able to kind of catch people where they are to just kind of digest your brand. But then you also need the good storytelling that once they're ready and the timing's right, that you're telling them something compelling that's going to make them want to buy.
Yeah. So it's sort of getting their attention is first and foremost through maybe the brand.
Yeah.
But then once you have their attention, you have to really hold their interest.
Right.
Right? And maybe that's where the story comes in. Because clearly if your website was just a picture of your logo, and that's it.
Right. I mean,
it's not, if people landed there eventually after seeing your sticker all over town or your billboard, right. It wouldn't necessarily mean anything.
Yeah, you have to pay it off in a cool way, right?
Yeah. Well, and what do you think about the concept? Kind of goes along with that. You know, there's folks out there that will say, "Okay, well, there's these," and to some degree, I think it's a little bit of a sales pitch, right? People will say, "Well, you should be doing these, you know, quote unquote, old fashioned things that people have moved away from because, well, now nobody's doing it. You'd be the only one doing it, right?" So for instance, like something like cold calling, right? There's a lot of these cold calling shops out there. They'll say, well, you know, you should be cold calling because none of your competitors are doing that anymore. They're all doing LinkedIn live videos and stuff. And that means that they're not getting cold calls from your competitors, for instance. And so you might be the only one doing it, right? Is there sort of a way of you can chase that sort of void and try to figure out what others aren't doing? Or is that sort of...
Maybe, and again, it depends on the channel. That's a tough one right there, the example that you brought up, because when's the last time you answered a call that from a number you didn't know?
Yeah. I mean, I've got apps that block it and right, automatically.
So, right. You know. And so, you know, that's a super sensitive hotspot. And even with numbers that you know, I know a lot of people that still don't pick up the phone.
Yeah, sure.
They would just rather text or email. And so that's, but you know, direct mail is another good example. It's like, again, we like to come back to the, what's the strategic business rationale for why you want to do that? Mm-hmm. So now if the rationale is all of our competitors have abandoned this and there's a void in the market where our message would be receptive, that's a solid business rationale. And if you can back that up with numbers, then you should go do that. If the rationale is, which is most of the time, that's the way we've always done it.
Yeah.
Then that's not a good business rationale,
and you should
really examine why you're doing it. And you know, we still get that a lot. Like, why are you doing that ad, that print ad, that no one will see?
Yeah.
Why are you doing that direct mail? Well, that's what we do. That's what we do in the spring. And so, you know, you have to really kind of put that stuff under the microscope. And I think just some very fundamental review of numbers will show maybe that that's not a good thing, or maybe it will show that, hey, we've been doing this and it's been successful, and our, you know, and that's one of the responses we got. We have the numbers to show that our clients kind of, they look forward to this and it turns into this amount of business every year. Well, keep doing it then.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. We shouldn't just turn stuff off for technology's sake when it's actually producing good results.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that, you know, it's a dynamic thing. You know, what works now didn't work 2 years ago. You know, you really, especially if you think about the like most bleeding edge stuff, but even long established successful channels don't work anymore, right? So if you look at, you know, the very first company I found, it was called Determisoft, right? This was back in 2003, I think we started the company, and our focus was e-commerce websites because everybody wanted to sell things online. Right. I mean, you know, Amazon was still sort of small and only sold books in 2003. and so it was, I want to sell this online. I want to sell that online. And we ran, at the time, it wasn't even Google Ads. There were some precursors to that that Yahoo and Google bought. Like one was called Overture, I believe. It was paid search result ads inside of Yahoo. So it was Yahoo searching. That's how, I mean, Google was not even the channel, right? And so we would spend, I mean, we were, I think, early adopters there, really, because we would spend $100 and get like 6 or 7 leads. You know, it was crazy. And actually, it wasn't fill out a web form or emails. It was call our 800 number, right? Our phone was ringing constantly, you know, from these. And we were paying, you know, $8, $10, whatever, a click maybe. And so we would get, you know, we ran those ads and just were constantly answering our phone. And I don't know how many leads total, maybe 40, 50, 60 leads in some time period for like maybe, we probably got like 60 leads for $3,000 or something, right? Which would be hard to do now.
Right.
Very hard. If you were advertising for e-commerce websites, I mean,
you would
pay $30,000 and get 20 leads. Maybe, right. And that's the problem. I mean, we actually don't run Google Ads at all now, just because when you're paying $150 a click and you're getting people that say, I got this idea, but I don't have any, you know, I'm just some guy on my own and it's not even a serious venture at all. It's just not, because there's no lead quality filters there, or at least it's hard to filter the lead qualities. So that channel, in my opinion, is just so spammy now. And of course, Google is trying to, you know, show more ads and kind of push it more down people's throats. But it seems like it's sort of struggling, in my opinion, to really show any value. It's too expensive and too messy, you know. And so the quality of those channels sort of change, I guess, basically.
Right. And now you've hit kind of that the other side of the curve on it, where, well, everybody does it, so we have to do something there.
Yeah.
And you're right. How are they going to now evolve to the next level to validate that kind of spend, because clients are already doing what you just described.
Yeah.
Right. Really taking a close look at it and say, man, we're not getting what we used to, because to be able to own this particular keyword in our industry, we had a stranglehold on it for 5 years and now we don't. And the bidding's gone through the roof and we just, it doesn't make sense anymore to try to own that.
Yeah. Well, another one of my customers, these guys have been customers for probably 12 years almost, so long standing. You know, they were spending maybe, I don't know, $10,000 a month on Google Ads, maybe $15,000, something like that. And over time, they built up organic content in their blog and stuff, and you know, tons of articles in there, very narrowly targeted to their local space and their services and what they do. And then they just shut off the Google Ads because they get all their traffic from their blog and organic now. Well, I mean, that saves them. I mean, whatever they spent on that was worth every single penny, you know?
And what they're spending on the new stuff is probably half of what they spent on Google.
Yeah. So, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because I think they're writing most of those blogs sort of in-house, right? Or maybe hired a writer or something, but it's nowhere near what Google would cost. So what about, you know, the very sort of bleeding edge stuff that's out there? You know, if we talk about AI, for instance, artificial intelligence, that's sort of a big topic out there. How are you seeing that affect the work you do around marketing on a sort of day-to-day basis, or what are clients asking for?
Yeah, so that's a really good question, and it's one of those definite bleeding edge things that's just going to continue to intensify in the years ahead. You look at the Face app that's out there now that uses artificial intelligence for the aging thing, and it took, you know, a matter of weeks for that to just explode on a global level, right? And just all of the buzz around it. And if you look at just the numbers in terms of just even like something as simple as customer service, while Gartner is saying 25% of customer service in all industries is going to use chatbot technology by next year. Mm. So that's amazing, right? In terms of just the, and that's not as sexy as the Face app thing or as cool or as interesting, but that's real business that's taking place every day in terms of how we're communicating with customers. And it used to be, again, they're ironing it out, all of the things that were clunky, creepy, right, as part of that. So now it feels very seamless, and what they're able to produce, 25% of all customer service interactions on AI just by next year. So that's game-changing, right? And so that affects every client that we have. And so how are they going to incorporate that into how they're using technology to maximize the resources they have internally, think about how they're doing even the sales process and the channel that they want to pursue. So it's big. And then I'd say on the bleeding edge side, the other two things that we're seeing that are really interesting is just the increasing use of video, and then personalization. And a lot of times those two things are tied together. So if you look at video, you know, we talked about the 21 touch points and you know, really trying to take the time to digest a brand story. The numbers right now are amazing. 70% of consumers say they've shared a brand's video at some point. 70% of everybody has shared at least one video.
Of 350 million Americans or whatever it is.
That's an enormous number, right?
3 billion or whatever Facebook users or something.
Right. And so you say, you know, you even said like the, you know, watching a video about how to do this particular thing, that can be drudgery, but 52% of consumers say watching product videos makes them more confident in their online purchase decisions. So they have a role, right? You shouldn't just produce a series of these to be your only brand story, but these videos can be one of those touch points that's going to push somebody over the line and impact their decision.
Social proof and all that, you know.
Right. You have this huge landscape, and you just have to really understand that not every single brand touch point that you put out there is to close a sale or to generate a lead. Some of it is just to build reputation. Some of it is to just build awareness, right? So you have to kind of prioritize what those look like, and you have to create this strategic kind of rollout of analyzing all these channels, analyzing the objective that you have that aligns with your strategy, and then making sure everything falls in the right bucket.
Makes me think of an article I read recently that was talking about and sort of discussing the question of, you know, why are there so many firms out there that are smaller firms that do great work, have a great small stable, say 30, 40 clients that they've done amazing work for, maybe even some big companies, but yet no one has ever heard of them, right? And it's encouraging, I think, because, you know, if you can tell that story well and use all these sort of lightweight channels and forms of content to tell that story and build that reputation, you know, then it gives you a chance sort of against maybe other bigger, much bigger firms. You can play on their same battlefield simply by being more authentic, more personalized, and really just moving faster, right? Because if you're a small company and you put an AI-driven chatbot on your website, for instance, well, you know, a lot of big companies don't have that, you know, and if they do, they're not doing it right. It's right. Salesy, it's junk, right?
And again, that comes down to a little bit of that brand story, right? How do you take this tool and do it in a compelling, story-driven kind of way to set yourself apart? So maybe if it's that big behemoth company in your space that you're dealing with, you're fresher, you're more creative, you're more nimble, faster. And so you can play on those differentiators, and you can do it in a way. And that's really the kind of the thing, right? All of these things allow you to create your own marketing network. And I say network like CBS, NBC kind of network, because it used to be that you would have, you know, the Cincinnati Inquirer. If you were going to advertise, you had to look at the Inquirer and see what that was going to look like. And the Inquirer is, you know, it's dying. And, you know, print journalism is not the place to do that spend all the time like it used to be. And so being able to kind of build your own network, so you look at some of these organizations and they have hundreds of thousands or millions of followers on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, they've got a much bigger audience that they've curated themselves than any media outlet could produce for them.
Yeah.
So now they can kind of be master of their own audience and be able to tell that story in a really interesting way. And it becomes kind of a newsroom kind of mentality, mm-hmm. that you have to be interesting and relevant on an ongoing basis, because you're not relying on the Business Courier or the Wall Street Journal or CBS to tell your story and to try to play that PR game and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. Some of these brands are really using those, you know, audiences they have to let sort of their personality shine through. Which the funny thing about it is, there's a part of me that, so for instance, like I'm thinking of Wendy's and Arby's and McDonald's, they have this Twitter war going on, right? And it's hilarious because, and I mean, I think it's really effective stuff because I can't think of some of the tweets they've had, but, you know, it'll say something like, I don't know, they'll rip on each other, for instance, you know, on Twitter, right?
But Wendy's making fun of the milkshake machine at McDonald's.
Something like that, right? And then, of course, then there's also like parody accounts out there, like Nihilist Arby's, which are hilarious. But, you know, it's interesting because it's like, is that a really super thought out, directed, like writing the content thing? Or is it just really like one guy or one girl who's running their social media who's just funny, you know? Because you can just hire a comedian and say, here's the login. Go rip on McDonald's,
right?
Here, and you have control of the Wendy's account because it happens so fast. And I don't know, maybe I'm being naive, but you know, the responses and stuff happen so fast and they're so it's really just a person talking. It doesn't seem like it's like something has to go through committee. So
no, it doesn't. And they've got, you know, it goes through one guy. And I think for the Wendy's example, I've read some case studies there that there's a team.
Yeah.
And, there's a guy that's in charge that I think filters all of it. But it's interesting because the skill set that you would look for that job isn't your traditional, you know, marketing manager or copywriter. It's more like a comedy copywriter is what you're looking for there. So, but but that is all born out of a strategy to say that we're going to be the leader not in being funny, but in being interesting and being compelling.
Yeah.
Because I've seen them translate that into people going to buy stuff, like what they did with the spicy nuggets.
Yeah.
Right? It turned into this really great thing that drove business. Well, so you can do all this stuff just to be funny and be cool and be hip, but if it doesn't turn into sales, that feels like a big waste of money, unless it's delivering enough on awareness and reputation that's having a secondary effect on sales. And that's the beauty of what Wendy's is doing, that they're being interesting and compelling, But it's directly hitting the bottom line for them, too.
So talk about what the spicy chicken nugget thing you're talking about, how that tied into it. Like, how is that related to...
Yeah, so it's a fan. I don't know the whole story, but it's a fan favorite. And they had, I think somebody kind of just tweet them a challenge to say if I got this many retweets on a tweet that you would bring back the spicy nuggets.
Okay.
And so they got behind it and they actually got the number and then they did it. and people lined up to get the product. So if you can do that, if you can turn something like that into sales, you know, that's the real beauty of what these kind of channels can do.
Yeah, you're right. Because I think it's nice to think that, well, we don't have to make a better cheeseburger. What we have to do is be funny on social media, right? But that doesn't mean people are going to come buy your cheeseburgers, right? They might just think, yeah, that account is hilarious.
Yeah, that account's hilarious, and I like watching it, but I would never eat there. Yeah. That's not good.
But there's the other side of the coin, which is, you know, if I can make my... say if I want to make my company or my restaurant appeal to a particular mindset of people, you know, young, rebellious millennials or something like that. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, is there a point at which they'll say, those are my people, right? Mm. You know, the people that run Wendy's, those are my people. So I'm going to go there. They're my tribe, right?
Sure.
Maybe. Yeah. You know,
That's part of the mindset of people. They like to be part of something bigger, right? Yeah. And hip and cool. Everybody wants to be cool.
Because I think we definitely see that like in the local brewing scene, for instance, in breweries, right? Like they, you know, the head brewer and all those people, I mean, they go out and they talk to the people and people start to sort of know those people. And you don't get that as much with any of the big brands. So I think Sam Adams and stuff have tried. They've had their founder in a lot of videos and I think they do a good job of that. But you know, and I think you see that locally, sort of the breweries that are always packed and always busy and crowded, it's because people think, hey, I like these people and I like their beer and, you know, and this is a place I can go hang out. Is it necessarily because their beer is better than the other guys? Sometimes, but not necessarily, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because most people are not that discerning of a palate, to be honest, you know?
Anything.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, you look at even the history of just product technology, you know, sometimes the very best technology wins out, and a lot of times it doesn't, you know, even back to VHS and Beta. VHS wins out because of it was just a better marketing tool, but Beta was the better technology back when we were kids. It's just all the more reason you need to have that strategic thing. So what are you trying to do? So Wendy's is going for funny and hip, and some brands decide that their personality is compassionate and charitable, and others decide that theirs is... you know, fast moving and trendy. Mm-hmm. So what is yours? That's part of the whole story. So here's our audience. Here's our message. Here's our brand personality. Here's our goals and objectives from a sales perspective. Here's our goals and objectives from a community impact perspective. And all of those weigh into how you start to pick and choose from the tool belt to know those smaller goals within the larger plan.
Yeah. And certainly if a client comes and says, look, we're sort of an aging brand and we need to make ourselves appear more youthful and stuff or whatever, you know, then some of these sort of strategies might work. But if they're already that way, they don't need to invest in, you know, maybe being more that way or whatever. Right?
Yeah. And sometimes, again, you have to look at that carefully and say, well, if you try to do that, here's how that's going to play. You got to really do it right.
Yeah.
And, you know, you risk really damaging a brand reputation if you do it wrong.
So. Sure. Definitely. I'm curious, with all these sort of options out there and all the new technologies that are available for clients, how are clients finding you and how are they engaging with you? Is a sort of engagement structure changed, you know, from a real, business standpoint? How has that sort of changed recently, you think, compared to the way you used to might have done things?
Honestly, that's probably one area that hasn't changed a whole lot since we started, and it's mostly intentional in terms of how we do that. But we fly pretty low on the radar in terms of, you know, being self-promoters and things like that. Almost all of our business comes from referrals, mm-hmm. or it comes from website and social media traffic that mm-hmm. we're the content that we're putting out there. And we're different than most agencies. I think a lot of agencies will come in and they will bid on an RFP, or they'll bid on a large scope of work that might be, you know, here we're doing this $250,000 project and it's got all these components and we're looking for somebody that can handle all of it. In almost every one of our client situations, we started with all of them on one small project mm-hmm. and then proved ourselves and then got more projects. And then ultimately became the agency of record for many of them. Mm-hmm. So it really became a thing of proving ourselves. Because, again, to me, to be able to go in and say, it's kind of like if I have $5,000, how should I spend it kind of a question.
Yeah.
When we come in and we kind of talk our talk about really trying to be strategic and lay that foundation and really understand all of the elements that go into making these decisions – that takes time. And so we were able to cultivate these relationships over a period of time with clients and be patient about how the projects come and when they come. And then we're able to get to that place where it's like we're impacting the strategic direction of the organization in a cool way and then managing, helping them manage the projects as they come out of that. So
yeah. Kind of iterative a little bit with what you do there rather than coming in and trying to deliver some huge giant.
Yeah, it's the
campaign.
Yeah, it's the over-deliver, under-promise kind of strategy, and that's worked for us so far. So we, and again, we're a small core team. But as we're able to kind of get into those clients and see what the challenges are and what they want to accomplish, then we're able to put, you know, we've got a stable of 12 to 15 contractors and vendors that we use depending mm-hmm. on what the need is. And so we're, again, really nimble. We can react quickly. We can get stuff done very quickly. And we show that to clients with those first couple of projects, and then it just grows from there. Because yeah. I think that's what gets missing with a lot of this new technology, right? It's like everything needs to be urgent and automated, and you know there's still a dynamic of you end up getting sold the business by a senior person, and a junior person ends up doing the work, right? Yeah. And so we don't do that either. We, you know, our senior team handles every engagement. And then we use only senior vendors and contractors and partners to do the work. So the clients feel that, and they know that they can't know 100 different marketing channels well.
Yeah.
And so they come to rely on us and our team to say, all right, I want you guys to handle this, 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 and this. And they know it'll get done by a senior team, and they can kind of check that off their list of having to worry about it every day.
Yeah.
And they can focus on other things.
It's a good point, and I certainly see that as well, that, you know, even the biggest firms, you can't have, there's so many new channels, so many new technologies are constantly evolving. You can't have, oh yeah, I got five guys that know this, 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 inside and out, on staff, full time. Even the biggest firms do not have that. They just don't, right?
Right.
So really part of our job, both basically being agencies, is managing those vendors and contractors for those sort of specialized niche things, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, you know, we have developers, you have copywriters, you know, those guys are always busy and always having a workload, right? But rather than your client having to go out and find a guy who can create a machine learning algorithm or right. something like that, you have some folks that, you know, you can rely on to do that. And you manage them, because sometimes those guys are, you know, maybe they're really good at what they do, but they have to be very, very managed. Tightly managed, right. right? Because maybe they're just a technical genius, right. you know?
And they need to be managed in a strategic way, again, that aligns with what we're
yeah.
overall trying to do and how it connects to all the other branding things that we're doing.
Yeah.
So we have a client that works with Fortune 100 companies regularly. In his business, and he had so we like to say that we become an extension of the client team.
Yeah.
So we're at your disposal, right, whenever you need something. So we had a client who was traveling, had a big pitch to make to Cisco, you know, six-figure contract that he was looking, got invited to come in unexpectedly that day. He calls us in the morning. He says, I'll be in the car. Here's what I need in terms of this proposal. I want it to look, it has to look I mean, it's Cisco. It has to look professional and branded and all these templates we've created. But he had all of these kind of unique numbers and information that he had to include in this proposal. He called us, and by the time he drove to the office that he was going to at Cisco, the PDF was in his inbox. And so we're able to react quickly because, again, if he had that team member, you know, at a desk back at in his office, that's what he would have asked him to do. So we want to be that extension of the team to be able to turn things quickly and take advantage of opportunities.
Yeah. And kind of be, you know, I think it's all about putting together a high performance team, right? Yeah. That's the secret sauce, because you can't just throw that together, and you can't just, like, somebody has to manage it, you know, and particularly like in the software development realm that I play in, you know, some folks think, well, I'll just put out a bunch of resumes. I don't really, you know, they don't know how to really interview developers. They don't know how to hire them. They don't, you know, especially if they're just starting out at it, and they throw a bunch of people in a room, and then it's just catastrophe because nobody's, they don't want to manage them either.
Yeah, you've talked about that dynamic with me many times, right? And that's a skill level that you have to be able to kind of sift through that stack of resumes to find somebody that really fits. And that's very similar to what we do in terms of, all right, we know that you don't know SEO and you don't know, you know, Facebook media buys.
Yeah.
We do. And we have partners that do as well. So let us manage that part and let us bring smart answers to you. And then we can go from there.
Yeah. Well, and I kind of tell people the same thing, like that, again, that $5,000 question that I asked you, it's like it, when people say, well, should I build this in, you know, Java or, you know, .NET or Ruby or PHP or Perl or Python or whatever, right? You know, the big long list. It's like, well, depends. Like, what's your strategy here, right? So, you know, it's not an easy, it's not an off-the-cuff answer, right?
Right.
So we talked also a little bit. I wanted to touch back on the question of storytelling, because I know that's something that's really key to the work that you do and some of the work you've done in the time I've known you. I mean, you've ghostwritten novels and stuff before, so you write a lot yourself. So when it comes to business content like that, you know, what do you think makes for good storytelling? You know, what are some of the aspects of that makes a good story?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's different for every client. And I think what's unique to all of that is that you have to find an element of the story that's germane to the business, right? But do it in a cool way. Don't, you know, you can try to puff your, a lot of it's just puffery, I think, where it's just talking about how great this guy is and how great this CEO is, and it doesn't really tell a story except for the kind of the story of that person. And so when we do a lot of white paper development. We've written some books with clients. We do short form stuff on social media, long form blogs, whatever it might be. But there should be some elements in there, again, that connect to a fundamental part of your brand story and something that you deliver that maybe your competitors don't, so that you can find that differentiation point. So it might be a white paper that, and we really like to do the kind of the problem solution kind of thing as well, especially on that longer form type of content. So what's the issue we ran into, and how did we solve it like nobody else could solve it, and do it in a really well-written, interesting, compelling way? And then at the end, making sure that you're tying a call to action in it. You know, we've had a lot of clients that tell us, well, we get right to that point, and then it's uncomfortable to ask for the sale, or it's uncomfortable to, you know, to really put a too strong of a call to action in there. You know, we kind of set our piece. We can kind of just let them go, but people want that. You kind of need that to jumpstart the next part of the process and get them to, if they don't agree, at least throw an objection at you, throw some reasons why, maybe that you didn't know before. And then that's really where you can put on that strategic hat and say, all right, I hear this problem, this problem, and this problem. You know what? I didn't mention this part of our product suite that can address those things that I didn't know before. And so now you're just extending that conversation. And if a white paper or a blog post or a social media post can just start a dialogue, you've won, right? You've gotten them talking, right? And then you can build from there.
So speaking of calls to action, something John wanted to offer folks is if they are listening to the podcast and they go to Color9's website, which is color-9.com, and they fill out their contact form in there and just reach out and ask for a t-shirt and a drink koozie. John will mail that to you so you can get a free t-shirt and drink koozie. Again, just go to color-9.com. So that's our call to action for people to reach out and get engaged. And if you have any questions about your marketing and the digital campaigns and stuff you're working on, feel free to mention that in the email on the web form as well. But John, we really appreciate you coming on the show. Hopefully sometime we can get back together and talk more about items or discuss sort of current events in the scene. Have you as a guest again.
No, that's good. Thanks, Sam. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Unstoppable Talk. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you did, be sure to support the show by leaving a 5-star review on iTunes. And learn more about this show by heading over to unstoppablesoftware.com. Until next time, keep innovating.